Welcome to Committing Faith in Public. This is the podcast for people who want to be inspired by individuals and communities of faith doing good work in public. Our guests tell stories of their work of weaving a more just, kind, and diversity-inclusive society. Our starting place for stories is Oklahoma because that is where we live, and because many people, both in Oklahoma and beyond, are surprised when they learn that interreligious friendly, pro-democracy, diversity welcoming, public good-oriented religion even exists in Oklahoma. So through this podcast, we're spreading good news and encouraging you in your faith and public life work. I'm Gary Peluso-Verden, President Emeritus at Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and working on the Religion and Public Life Initiative for the seminary. So I'm at Fellowship Congregational Church, United Church of Christ Church in Tulsa. Our guest today is the pastor, the Reverend Chris Moore. And I'm here to talk with him about this congregation's, what I would think is a nearly unique ministry in Tulsa, in its historic public stances on social issues, and what led Chris and the congregation to display its nativity set last Advent and Christmas season in a way that caught the attention of, from what I could see online, the New York Times, CNN, Fox, USA Today. Did I miss anybody on that list?
Yeah.
Pretty much that.
NPR.
NPR, that's right, and NPR, yep. So welcome, so glad you're here.
Me too.
First, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself. Why don't you say something about the path in ministry that led you to become the pastor here at Fellowship?
So I'm a second career pastor. That's a growing rank these days, for sure, and someone who kind of came back to the church later in life and came back through social justice causes at the church, connection there, and when I moved back to Oklahoma, joined a church in Oklahoma City,
Mayflower,
congregational, and that was the first time I was really ever exposed to any great amount to the United Church of Christ. And Mayflower is a big church, and I was there as a member for 10 years before I decided to go back to seminary. And
which was where?
At Phillips Theological Seminary.
Full disclosure.
We knew we'd have an opportunity to say that at some point. And so that was where the senior minister at Mayflower had graduated from, and lots of the people in the area had gone to that school. So it was not only geographically a natural fit, but turned out to be just a really very, very positive experience for me. And I had the unique ability amongst my classmates of somebody who could actually take something that Brandon Scott said in class and take it to the Bible study that I was teaching unedited.
Right.
And
at Mayflower.
At Mayflower. And it was, and people loved that. So I didn't have the problem that lots of other folks do. How do they take that information and present it to their congregation? In the midst of that work at Mayflower when I was in seminary, thanks to the donation of an individual, we had some money to further the cause of the UCC in the Oklahoma City area. Mm-hmm. And it was decided by a group of people to try to start a church in Norman. Norman seemed like a good ground for that.
University town.
Right. So I ended up being the founding pastor of what is now called First Congregational of Norman, which was then called Norman UCC.
Mm-hmm. And I'd forgotten that.
That started in the living room of Don and Kay Holliday, who are still members there, very active part of that church, and of course, well-known amongst the LGBTQ community for their... Don was one of the attorneys on the marriage equality lawsuit, and Kay's tireless work for PFLAG continues to this day. So... lovely people, and we started that in their living room, and then I was there for about 4 years and ended up going back to Mayflower as the first associate there. So came back and that had that transition and served there for about 4 years as well when this position came open in Tulsa. The UCC is not very big in the state of Oklahoma.
Right.
So when full-time positions open up, you have to really seriously consider that. And I don't know that I was completely ready to leave Mayflower, but it was certainly an opportunity for me. There was another associate in Lori Walkie there, mm-hmm. who I felt mm-hmm. could handle all of those tasks and more. And so I came up here. It will be 7 years in December.
Very good.
I started December 1st, 7 years ago.
Very good. And when I said at the opening that this is a unique or nearly unique congregation mm-hmm. in Tulsa, I'm sure that a large part of that, legacy, that reflects a legacy of Russ Bennett.
Indeed.
Why don't you say a little bit about who Russ Bennett was?
Yeah, Russ was the pastor here for 37-ish years, a very long tenure, even in UCC circles, and was just pivotal in the community. You, of course, knew him. Lots of people knew him. Mm-hmm. He casts a very long shadow here mm-hmm. And did some really groundbreaking work, not only with the organizations that exist, but then really helped found the Tulsa Interfaith Alliance mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. do a lot of groundbreaking work in really specific and profound ways. I mean, it's hard to understate the impact that he's had. Mm-hmm. That's sort of witnessed by the fact that when you move into town as the new pastor of the church that he served, it's just a little intimidating mm-hmm. to look around and right. note that, like, most of the awards at the big organizations around town are named after Russ Bennett.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
He certainly left an impact on this church, and still have quite a few people in the congregation who love him dearly and miss him terribly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in his long tenure here, were there times that the church has taken a stance that was kind of controversial and relatively conservative Christian Tulsa or Oklahoma area prior to the stance that the church and you took regarding immigration, the border, and the like, the nativity set, which we're going to get to in a little bit. But have there been other times that were preparatory?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, so it was a different time and a different era. So how you live those things out.
Right, that's true.
You know, there was no social media then.
Right.
So
right.
Russ was published a lot in the paper, was sort of, you know, really well known, letters to the editor mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. Was very visible, lots of newspaper articles, lots of public speaking that he would do on a variety of issues. And then he was, you know, the person who really helped carry this church into its open and affirming stance. And mm-hmm. that was, mm-hmm. you know, in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It's been a long time
right.
That this church has been openly mm-hmm. open and affirming. Mm-hmm. And has he led the church through the process that the United Church of Christ has, so that the congregation took a vote on that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nearly unanimous vote. Mm-hmm. There were some families that left, mm-hmm. But that it was important to make that stance,
mm-hmm.
And to, you know, it's important to have that process. In other mm-hmm. words, so that mm-hmm. you know, he knew that he could say in a public way,
mm-hmm.
if you were LGBTQ+, mm-hmm. Which was not the language that was used
of course,
then,
right.
that you would be welcome here, and that he could move from that vote forward mm-hmm. in a much more public
okay.
sort of way.
Okay.
And did so.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about what happened just about a year ago now. If I remember correctly from the newspaper articles, there was a trip you took to the border mm-hmm. That I want you to say something about. And then there was something about that you had put a fence around the nativity set, but it wasn't until changing the signboard
yeah.
out front that a lot of attention started coming your way.
The impetus for this began really from our involvement, from the congregation's involvement with the New Sanctuary Network, and really a growing and expanding effort to contend with the ramifications of some real serious policy changes by this administration in regards to immigration. And that took many forms for us, but one of them was noting that, you know, it's important to note that this idea of putting a fence around the nativity set was not original to us.
Right, right.
In good preacher fashion, we stole, you know, a good idea from somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
And credit where credit is due, there was an Episcopal church in Indianapolis. It's actually several churches around the country who had done this kind of, let's say, liturgical art.
Right. It certainly is a public art demonstration. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah, and that was the point of that. Now, what was interesting is that we brought that up as the congregation and the council, you know, our leadership, and the idea was unanimously supported. So we had that. We put the fence up, and most of the responses we were getting were somewhere along the lines of, "Oh, how sad! Somebody is stealing your, you know, your right. pieces from your nativity, and you've had to protect it." And I was like, "This art ain't working. Right? We got to fix something about this because we're not getting across the message." So, our sign, for better or for worse, is probably one of the ways that we are known in the community. We have a marquee sign that sits out right on Harvard
Avenue.
It's way out at the front of our property.
8,000 cars a day see
it. And it's pretty visible. So we changed the sign to really speak to what we were trying to get across and to be honest with you now, I don't even remember what we put on the sign. But it was clear that we were making that connection to the nativity scene.
Jesus was a migrant was one of the words in the sign.
Yeah, maybe it was Jesus was a migrant. Yeah,
something like that. Yeah,
or something along those lines, which is kind of what we were trying to get across with that whole scene of the nativity. And that's when attention really rose very quickly. It was local news stations who I think were just driving past and saw that, and and that was within hours of changing the marquee. Literally, we had local folks, and then it just kind of climbed from there. To be honest with you, I never thought it was going to be a piece that was going to generate media exposure. In fact, I did not seek that or go out. And then we wrestled for a while about whether we were going to post that on social media, whether we were going to do something beyond. Because for us, it was really just a statement. It was an art piece that we were trying to push forth to people who witnessed it, who saw it, and not have it be more than that. But to, you know, to go back to our discussion about Russ and the way that he did things, it's a very different world, and you have sometimes less control than you used to have over what happens.
Right.
And so you have to know here's going to come the onslaught, and you have to be prepared for that because the media is going to ask you all kinds of questions, and then they're going to go in and edit out the 15 seconds of the most provocative thing that you said, and it may not even be the thing, like, sometimes it's out of context, and, you know, so
right
you just have to know that that's coming.
Right. You might have tried to nuance something that they didn't either want
nuance
or catch the
work.
Nuance.
No, not especially not on TV media.
Right.
You when can there's occasionally get clips. That in print media.
Yeah. So what were the local reactions, and how did you learn? How were those local reactions communicated to you?
Well, in a variety of ways. Most of them were posts on the Facebook page. And then a lot of people who would call, they would typically call after hours and leave a message on the on the answering machine. And so we just kind of, you know, came to expect we'd come in the morning, there'd be several messages. Now, they were not really the overall percentage. I would say 60-40 positive. There were, you know, several messages that were clearly not, you know, supportive of this, and most of that centered around the Jesus is a refugee claim.
Huh.
Well, that's not, you know, you're wrong about that.
Oh, okay.
It was interesting. You know, I was like, well, you can go read Matthew if you like, but I don't know how you don't get that from
me. Right, only if you excise Matthew from the Bible.
Right.
Can you actually say he wasn't? Right, weird.
Well, there was argument about, you know, whether he was, you know, seeking, you know, asylum or, you know, that sort of, you know, discussion about,
immigrant, migrant, refugee, asylum, all different.
Right. As if the only place to have any comment from the Bible on how we should treat strangers or migrants is in Matthew.
Right.
Like, that's colored by all these other statements, which are all over the place.
Like the Torah.
Right.
Everywhere. There were national reactions, but did you get any, besides the media attention, did you get, you know, people from elsewhere in the country who
contacted the church and either said yay or boo because of this going on?
We got some notice. You know, the National Church, the UCC, contacted us. Tracy Blackman, who's the the head of the Justice Witness Ministries, left a message on that on the answering machine, a very nice message of support, and got some support from other places as well. The New York Times did a nice feature, a nice piece on it. Mostly, I think the interest from the national media was not, oh, here's something new and unique, because this had happened. They knew that this had happened in other places, whereas I'm not sure local people necessarily knew that. But it was the sense of that happening in the what is considered the buckle of the Bible Belt you know, here in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Right.
And that gave another little edge to it, I think, that made it interesting.
Speaking of the buckle of the Bible Belt, also we enjoy in Tulsa what a lot of folks in the country don't know, which is a really strong interfaith, interreligious community.
Yeah.
I assume that you had a bunch of your friends. Chris is really involved in the larger community, both in social justice and kind of moral order matters around here, as well as with the interfaith community. So I assume you had lots of support coming from your friends and colleagues around town.
I did. Now, you know, to be fair, it was a particularly Christian-specific provocation. And so that there were some who didn't necessarily understand. They knew that it was a big deal, that I was getting a lot of exposure. We had some talk about, so why was that? That's not as much as you think. I mean, certainly the Muslim folks in town are familiar with that story. The Jewish folks in town, certainly the rabbis were very familiar with that story and that connection. Yeah, there was a good support, sort of that sense of, you know, oddly enough, in the interfaith community, it's not even odd at all, frankly. It's you have also a high degree, a high percentage of immigrants.
Right.
You have people who, you know, who maybe are first generation here or even second generation here, but have a real tie culturally and religiously to this sense of the Jews every year as part of their ritual. You know, they're doing this Passover, and they're remembering. In fact, they're told this isn't something. This is you. Like we live this out.
Right.
This ritual
is today.
Is you.
Right. This is today.
You are freed from slavery in Egypt. Right. And so, it's that whole sense of ownership of where we came from and what our story is like.
In the interviews with the national media that I read, you repeated multiple times that there's a difference between addressing a matter that is political and moral and trying to stay away from partisan politics.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the reactions you got from people either locally or nationally, how well did you think people hear that distinction between something which is moral and political, where we have value propositions we're bringing from our faith traditions that are intersecting or conflicting with value propositions in political realm versus a church and state matter?
Yeah, I don't think they hear that at all. My experience is that's the toughest part of the argument to make. And in part, you know, I come from a tradition here in both the Congregational Church and the United Church of Christ that has a strong belief in the separation of church and state, but also is able to maintain this strong belief that the gospel is inherently political, and so you have to engage in those issues. So you have to hold that tension and be able to do that in effective ways. This was a challenge, and we thought about that. And to be honest with you, one of the things I tried to say in every interview that I had, and some of the interviews that didn't make the cut, was to say that we did this liturgical art piece in part because, as a means of confession, that we also had not in the previous 8 years of an administration that was also deporting a lot of people.
That's true.
Albeit in very, very different ways.
Right.
But still deporting a lot of people, and the immigration system was just as broken then and just as flawed and just as racist then as it is now, and we were really saying nothing about that. And so there is a place, I think, for us to do some self-examination about saying, okay, well, we want to claim, we want to hold this high ideal, and how well are we living that out? Like, so it should be acknowledged that we did wait until there was a shift in party politics, and that's when our outrage grew up, and so we have to, I think, you know, have a conversation as church and as activists to say, if we claim these as moral positions, then they're moral positions regardless of who's in office.
Right.
Even though we have to admit we are partisan in the sense that we belong to or adhere to a particular party, I think there's a lot of conversation going on right now, really interesting conversation, especially amongst younger folk who are just not prescribing to that binary anymore. And they're just not like, I don't care what label you're going to put on this. This is what I think is right. And so you see that in the rise of evangelicals who are resisting sort of the GOP platform.
Right. Especially the younger evangelicals.
Right. And saying, no, wait a second. Can't go along.
Absolutely. Well, I really admire you trying to make that distinction between religion and politics on the one hand and church and state on the other. I teach that.
Yeah.
I teach that in every Sunday school class when I have an opportunity, and I teach that in my Christianity Democracy class. And it is. It's a, once you see the difference, you see why they're necessarily related.
Yeah.
As in religion and politics, whereas church and state, yes, it's not a big thick wall, but there is a fence. There's Swiss cheese. There is a division between the two, between a state supported church, or state supported religion versus a public square in which people of different faith viewpoints are bringing their viewpoints and trying to affect policy eventually based on it, as well as just the basic question of what kind of society we want to live in. Mm-hmm. What do we owe to our neighbors?
Religion and politics both talk about values. And so we come to those things, we come to those ideologies on one side or theologies on another based on those values.
Yep,
so how
absolutely.
Do we talk about those things? And in some ways, it's just different sets of language for talking about the same thing.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And so how do we use one to influence the other? And how do we really, beyond that, beyond the influence conversation, I think it's important that we are able to have some integrity about those two things. So that, to me, is the real issue, is that we have people who clearly ascribe to a set of values on Sunday morning that they cast aside Wednesday through Saturday, and operate in a totally different,
which makes the faith irrelevant to a good part of life.
Right.
Did the liturgical art display and all the reactions that, again, you said the church didn't really anticipate, all of the public attention it would get. So how did this affect the conversations within the congregation?
So it's a congregation that, you know, as going back to Russ's long shadow, that's very used to having that sort of political umbrella hanging over them, so to speak. And so that it's just not new to them. And the controversy is not new to them. So, you know, I think it's really probably important to say that in my tenure, which has again only been 6 years, that was not even the biggest. This is a congregation who, a couple of years into my tenure, was protested for 6 weeks in a row by a very, you know, sort of a Westboro Baptist style group that stood out on our edges of our property and had bullhorns, and you could hear them during service shouting terrible things and holding up signs. And they did that pretty aggressively for several weeks in a row, including Easter Sunday.
Right. That's right. Easter Sunday, right. I think that was the same year they showed up at the seminary's graduation.
They did, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a group that I'd had experience with before at Mayflower and in other places, but that this congregation hadn't had, and they hadn't been protested in that form or fashion before. So it was a new thing. So, you know, to have some controversy about through the media and a few phone calls seemed fairly minor, I think, at that point. They were, and it was a, you know, it's an issue that the congregation feels very strongly about. Mm-hmm. So
I think it's really interesting to pastor a congregation that is in this stage of its life cycle and existence, where they've been well prepared over time to think about the public and moral and religious and the personal and all, mm-hmm. all mixed up, mixed in together.
Right.
To think of it as a unit. Have you been a part of a congregation at all that that was starting from a very different place, that maybe didn't have all that great ground preparation, so that, like you said, this business with the nativity set wasn't even the most controversial right. thing that you had, or difficult right. thing you had to deal with in a mere 6 years? Because
yeah.
I'm thinking about people listening to this who may be thinking, well, I wonder if my congregation could do something like that, and what advice you might have if they're thinking about a prophetic action, but they may be at a different part of their life cycle as far mm-hmm. as the groundwork or the spade work having been done for this kind of public act.
My advice would be that you have to think about that groundwork first. Now, I am lucky that I came in here, again, Russ having really prepared that ground, but really even before that, to think about the whole tenure. The church started in 1950, and it started as a split from Second Presbyterian Church. And that split occurred because the pastor of Second Presbyterian in 1950 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was wanting to join a black couple to the church who had come and mm-hmm. attended. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, roundly denounced by the presbytery. And mm-hmm. He was eventually brought up on charges even because mm-hmm. he was going to go ahead and do it. And they told him no. And then they were going to bring him up on charges. Mm-hmm. He eventually left the church and took about half of them with him. And started Fellowship. Then, ironically, the story is several years later here at Fellowship, then an African-American couple came to join, and they weren't allowed to even hear, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. that conversation mm-hmm. really continued, mm-hmm. and not in ways that went one direction mm-hmm. like you would expect. Mm-hmm. And by the time you brought new people in, then mm-hmm. you had recreated that, mm-hmm. right? So I say it's important work for pastors to do provocative things with their congregation in the ways that they can do them. And that'll be contextual.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the argument was always had in classes at seminary that people would always say, well, this is really eye-opening to me, this information mm-hmm. I'm mm-hmm. getting and this mm-hmm. new way of thinking, but I can't take it back mm-hmm. to my folks right. in small-town Oklahoma right. and do this. And that was an easy, I think, out. And not enough pressure was put on us as leaders to say, yeah, but you can. And if you believe that that's the truth and it's eye-opening to you and expands your faith, why do you not think that will happen for other people?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Depending on how you frame it. Like, that's your task mm-hmm. now, is how do mm-hmm. you go and frame that for folks? Now, that's easy for me to say because I didn't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. I'd just come back and just... Mm-hmm. regurgitate mm-hmm. straight from my notes, and everything was great.
In fact, it would be expected of you.
In fact, yeah, my challenge is actually the opposite. Uh-huh. Like, in some ways, like, how do I help people appreciate their place in the tradition, mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. to and mm-hmm. and before we throw the baby out with the bathwater, mm-hmm. let's mm-hmm. let's look at some of the reasons that, and let's look at some of the theologies and some of the, like, you know, amongst white liberal congregations, of which my church is deeply ingrained in that tradition, we don't have a very good theology of sin. In fact, we don't have any theology of sin often. And that's really critical for us if we're beginning to talk about white privilege.
Absolutely.
Or we're beginning right. to talk about really examining our history or looking at our place in the world and the role that particularly people who look like me, mm-hmm. white heterosexual males, mm-hmm. you know, cisgendered males, how we impacted mm-hmm. this country. And mm-hmm. if we don't have some sort of sense of contrition mm-hmm. or confession and then mm-hmm. absolution, and mm-hmm. it's a really challenging piece of work to do.
It is. And I think it's not only the seeing it systemically, but one's personal stake in keeping things as they are or making things
right.
different. It's
right.
a personal stake, not just a, it's not just about changing the system.
Right.
I mean, the systems in some ways reflect what goes on inside of each of us.
So that's the groundwork that's yeah. important to do at churches. And I think you can get there in lots of ways. We tend to do church in ways that are really comfortable, and we sort of drift towards the comfort side mm-hmm. of things. And I mm-hmm. think we actually need to think about, even if you're talking about changing the carpet,
mm-hmm.
which can be one of the most controversial mm-hmm. things
right.
in the church, right?
Right.
How do you use that as a chance to talk about sin and forgiveness mm-hmm. and, you know, confession mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. absolute all of those things. Mm-hmm. How do you use that as an opportunity to begin to lay the groundwork so that when you get to a tougher conversation mm-hmm. like white privilege, mm-hmm. you have some foundation to build on? And maybe you're not even doing it for you. Maybe, like Russ Bennett, you're building for a future down right. the road and, right. and knowing that you're always trying to establish something coming.
Great. Chris, if people want to know more about Fellowship Congregational Church, where would you send them besides your physical address here on Harvard? What's your internet address?
Well, we are at ucctulsa.org, so you can always go there, or you can Google fellowship. Well, there's several fellowship churches in Tulsa.
There are.
There's of different denominations, so you'd have to be sure to include UCC as part of that. We are the only UCC church east of I-35 in the state, so we are, we're kind of out here on an island in terms of the United Church of Christ, and also not a denomination that's very well known
in this part of the country.
Yeah, right. Yep. So and usually connected to the Church of Christ, which we don't have that connection.
Right, which is well known in this part of the country.
Exactly. Right. And we come from a different perspective than the Church of
Very
Christ.
Much. We're grateful for it. Yeah. Chris Moore, thank you so much for being on Committing Faith in Public, which you all do really well.
Well, thank you.
Take care.
This has been Committing Faith in Public, a podcast from the Religion and Public Life Initiative at Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Copyright PTS and Gary Peluso-Verdend. The views and opinions expressed during the podcast are those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect an official position of Phillips Theological Seminary.